about 1 in 20 patients once they reach a hospital. Marburg is one of a family of viruses known as the filoviruses. Marburg was the first filovirus to be discovered. The word filovirus is Latin and means thread virus. The filoviruses look alike as if they are sisters, and they resemble no other virus on Earth. While most viruses are ball-shaped particles that look like peppercorns, the thread viruses have been compared to strands of tangled rope, to hair, to worms, to snakes. When they appear in a great flooding mess, as they so often do when they've destroyed a victim, they look like a tub of spaghetti that has been dumped on the floor. Marburg particles sometimes roll up into loops. The loops resemble Cheerios. Marburg is the only ring-shaped virus known. In Germany, the effects of Marburg virus on the brain were particularly frightening and resembled the effects of rabies. The virus somehow damaged the central nervous system and could destroy the brain, as does rabies. The Marburg particles also looked rather like rabies particles. The rabies virus particle is shaped like a bullet. If you stretch out a bullet, it begins to look like a length of rope. And if you coil the rope into a loop, it becomes a ring like Marburg. Thinking that Marburg might be related to rabies, they called it stretched rabies. Later it became clear that Marburg belongs to its own family. Not long after Charles Monnet died, it was established that the family of filoviruses comprised Marburg along with two types of a virus called Ebola. The Ebolas were named Ebola Zaire and Ebola Sudan. Marburg was the mildest of the three filovirus sisters. The worst of them was Ebola Zaire. The kill rate in humans infected with Ebola Zaire is 9 out of 10. 90% of the people who come down with Ebola Zaire die of it. Ebola Zaire is a slate wiper in humans. Marburg virus, the gentle sister, affects humans somewhat like nuclear radiation, damaging virtually all of the tissues in their bodies. It attacks with particular ferocity the internal organs, connective tissue, intestines, and skin. In Germany, all the survivors lost their hair. They went bald or partly bald. Their hair died at the roots and fell out in clumps, as if they had received radiation burns. Hemorrhage occurred from all orifices of the body. I have seen a photograph of one of the men who died of Marburg, taken in the hours before his death. He's lying in bed without any clothing on his upper body. His face is expressionless. His chest, arms, and face are speckled with blotches and bruises, and droplets of blood stand on his nipples. During the survivors' recovery period, the skin peeled off their faces, hands, feet, and genitals. Some of the men suffered from blown-up, semi-rotten testicles. One of the worst cases of this appeared in a morgue attendant who had handled Marburg-infected bodies. The virus also lingered in the fluid inside the eyeballs of some victims for many months. No one knows why Marburg has a special affinity for the testicles and the eyes. One man infected his wife with Marburg through sexual intercourse. Doctors noticed that the Marburg agent had a strange effect on the brain. Most of the patients showed a sullen, slightly aggressive, or negativistic behavior, according to the book. Two patients had a feeling as if they were lying on crumbs. One patient became psychotic, apparently as a result of brain damage. The patient named Hans O.V. showed no signs of mental derangement, and his fever cooled, and he seemed to be stabilizing. But then suddenly, without warning, he had an acute fall in blood pressure, he was crashing, and he died. They performed an autopsy on him, and when they opened his skull, they found a massive fatal hemorrhage at the center of the brain. He had bled out into his brain. international health authorities were urgently concerned to find the exact source of the monkeys in order to pin down where in nature the Marburg virus lived. It seemed pretty clear that the Marburg virus did not naturally circulate in monkeys. Because it killed them so fast, it could not successfully establish itself in them as a useful host. Therefore, Marburg lived in some other kind of host. An insect? A rat? A spider? A reptile? Where, exactly, had the monkeys been trapped? That place would be the hiding place of the virus. Soon after the outbreak in Germany, a team of investigators under the auspices of the World Health Organization flew to Uganda to try to find out where those monkeys had come from. It turned out they had been trapped at locations all over central Uganda. The team couldn't discover the exact source of the virus. There the mystery lingered for many years. Then, in 1982, an English veterinarian came forward with new eyewitness information about the Marburg monkeys. I will call this man Mr. Jones. Today, he prefers to remain anonymous. During the summer of 1967, when the virus erupted in Germany, Mr. Jones was working at a temporary job inspecting monkeys at the export facility in Entebbe, from which the sick Marburg monkeys had been shipped, while the regular veterinary inspector was on leave. This monkey house, which was run by a rich monkey trader, a sort of lovable rogue, according to Mr. Jones, was exporting about 13,000 monkeys a year to Europe. This was a very large number of monkeys, and it generated big money. The infected shipment was loaded onto an overnight flight to London, and from there it was flown to Germany, where the virus broke out of the monkeys and attempted to establish itself in the human population. After making a number of telephone calls, I finally located Mr. Jones in a town in England, where today he's working as a veterinary consultant. He said to me, "All that the animals got before they were shipped off was a visual inspection." "By whom?" I asked. "By me," he said. "I inspected them to see that they appeared normal. On occasion, with some of these shipments, one or two animals were injured or had skin lesions." His method was to pick out the sick-looking ones, which were removed from the shipment and presumably killed before the remaining healthy-looking animals were loaded onto the plane. When, a few weeks later, the monkeys started the outbreak in Germany, Mr. Jones felt terrible. "I was appalled because I had signed the export certificate," he said to me. "I feel now that I have the deaths of these people on my hands, but that feeling suggests I could have done something about it. There was no way I could have known." He's right about that. The virus was then unknown to science, and as few as two or three not visibly sick animals could have started the outbreak. One concludes that the man should not be blamed for anything. The story becomes more disturbing. He went on. "The sick ones were being killed, or so I thought." But later he learned that they weren't being killed. The boss of the company was having the sick monkeys put in boxes and shipped out to a small island in Lake Victoria, where they were being released. With so many sick monkeys running around it, the island could have become a focus for monkey viruses. It could have been a hot island, an isle of plagues. Then, if this guy was a bit short of monkeys, he went out to the island and caught a few, unknown to me. Mr. Jones thinks it is possible that the Marburg agent had established itself on the hot island and was circulating among the monkeys there, and that some of the monkeys which ended up in Germany had actually come from that island. But when the WHO team came later to investigate, I was told by my boss to say nothing unless asked. As it turned out, no one asked Mr. Jones any questions. He says he never met the World Health Organization team. The fact that the team apparently never spoke with him, the monkey inspector, was bad epidemiology but good politics, he remarked to me. If it had been revealed that the monkey trader was shipping off suspect monkeys collected on a suspect island, he could have been put out of business, and Uganda would have lost a source of valuable foreign cash. Shortly after the Marburg outbreak, Mr. Jones recalled a fact that began to seem important to him. Between 1962 and 1965, he had been stationed in eastern Uganda, on the slopes of Mount Elgon, inspecting cattle for diseases. At some time during that period, local chiefs told him that the people who lived on the north side of the volcano, along the Greek River, were suffering from a disease that caused bleeding, death, and a peculiar skin rash, and that monkeys in the area were dying of a similar disease. Mr. Jones did not pursue the rumors, and was never able to confirm the nature of the disease. But it seems possible that in the years preceding the outbreak of Marburg virus in Germany, a hidden outbreak of the virus occurred on the slopes of Mount Elgon. Mr. Jones's personal vision of the Marburg outbreak reminds me of a flashlight pointed down a dark hole. It gives a narrow but startling view of the larger phenomenon of the origin and spread of tropical viruses. He told me that some of the Marburg monkeys were trapped in a group of islands in Lake Victoria known as the Seisei Islands. The Seiseis are a low-lying, forested archipelago in the northwestern part of Lake Victoria, an easy boat ride from Entebbe. The Isle of Plagues may have been situated among the Seiseis or near them. Mr. Jones doesn't recall the name of the hot island. He says it's close to Entebbe. At any rate, Mr. Jones's then boss, the Entebbe monkey trader, had arranged a deal with villagers in the Seisei Islands to buy monkeys from them. They regarded the monkeys as pests and were happy to get rid of them, especially for money. So the trader was obtaining wild monkeys from the Seisei Islands, and if the animals proved to be sick, he was releasing them again on another island somewhere near Entebbe. And some monkeys from the Isle of Plagues seemed to be ending up in Europe. In papyrus reeds and desolate flatlands on the western shore of Lake Victoria facing the Seisei Islands, there's a fishing village called Casancero. You can see the Seisei Islands from the village. Casancero was one of the first places in the world where AIDS appeared. Epidemiologists have since discovered that the northwestern shore of Lake Victoria was one of the initial epicenters of AIDS. It's generally believed that AIDS came originally from African primates, from monkeys and apes, and that it somehow jumped out of these animals into the human race. It's thought that the virus went through a series of very rapid mutations at the time of its jump from primates to humans, which enabled it to establish itself successfully in people. In the years since the AIDS virus emerged, the village of Casancero has been devastated. The virus has killed a large portion of the inhabitants. It's said that other villages along the shores of Lake Victoria have been essentially wiped off the map. The villagers of Casancero are fishermen who were, and are, famous as smugglers. In their wooden boats and motorized canoes, they ferried illegal goods back and forth across the lake, using the Seisei Islands as hiding places. One can guess that if a monkey trader were moving monkeys around Lake Victoria, he might call on the Casancero smugglers or on their neighbors. One general theory for the origin of AIDS goes that during the late 1960s, a new and lucrative business grew up in Africa, the export of primates to industrialized countries for use in medical research. Uganda was one of the biggest sources of these animals. As the monkey trade was established throughout Central Africa, the native workers in the system, the monkey trappers and handlers, were exposed to large numbers of wild monkeys, some of which were carrying unusual viruses. These animals, in turn, were being jammed together in cages, exposed to one another, passing viruses back and forth. Furthermore, different species of monkeys were mixed together. It was a perfect setup for an outbreak of a virus that could jump species. It was also a natural laboratory for rapid virus evolution, and possibly it led to the creation of HIV. Did HIV crash into the human race as a result of the monkey trade? Did AIDS come from an island in Lake Victoria? A hot island? Who knows? When you begin probing into the origins of AIDS and Marburg, the light fails and things go dark. But you sense hidden connections. Both viruses seem part of a pattern. When he learned what Marburg virus does to human beings, Dr. David Silverstein persuaded the Kenyan health authorities to shut down Nairobi Hospital. For a week, patients who arrived at the doors were turned away, while 67 people were quarantined inside the hospital, mostly medical staff. They included the doctor who had done the autopsy on Monet, nurses who had attended Monet or Dr. Musoke, the surgeons who had operated on Musoke, and aides and technicians who had handled any secretions from either Monet or Musoke. It turned out that a large part of the hospital's staff had had direct contact with either Monet or Musoke, or with blood samples and fluids that came from the two patients. The surgeons, who had operated on Musoke, remembering only too well that they had been up to the elbows in blood, sweated in quarantine for 2 weeks while they wondered if they were going to break with Marburg. A single human virus bomb had walked into the casualty waiting room and exploded there, and the event had put the hospital out of business. Charles Monet had been an Exocet missile that struck the hospital below the waterline. Dr. Shem Musoke survived his encounter with a hot agent. 10 days after he fell sick, the doctors noticed a change for the better. Instead of merely lying in bed in a passive state, he became disoriented and angry and refused to take medicine. One day, a nurse was trying to turn him over in bed, and he waved his fist at her and cried, "I have a stick and I will beat you." It was around that time that he began to get better, and after many days his fever subsided and his eyes cleared. His mind and personality came back, and he recovered slowly but completely. Today, he's one of the leading physicians at Nairobi Hospital, where he practices as a member of David Silverstein's group. One day I interviewed him, and he said to me that he has almost no memory of the weeks he was infected with Marburg. "I only remember bits and pieces," he said. "I remember having major confusion. I remember, before my surgery, that I walked out of my room with my IV drip hanging out of me. I remember the nurses just turning me and turning me in bed. I don't remember much of the pain. The only pain I can talk about is the muscle ache and the lower back ache. And I remember him throwing up on me." Nobody else at the hospital developed a proven case of Marburg virus disease. When a virus is trying, so to speak, to crash into the human species, the warning sign may be a spattering of breaks at different times and places. These are microbreaks. What had happened at Nairobi Hospital was an isolated emergence, a microbreak of a rainforest virus with unknown potential to start an explosive chain of lethal transmission in the human race. Tubes of Dr. Musoke's blood went to laboratories around the world so that they could have samples of living Marburg for their collections of life forms. The Marburg in his blood had come from Charles Monet's black vomit and perhaps originally from Katoom Cave. Today, this particular strain of Marburg virus is known as the Musoke strain. Some of it ended up in glass vials in freezers owned by the United States Army, where it was kept immortal in a zoo of hot agents. A Woman and a Soldier, 1983, September 25th, 1800 hours. Thurmont, Maryland, nearly 4 years after the death of Charles Monet. Evening, a typical American town. On Catoctin Mountain, a ridge of the Appalachians that runs north to south through the western part of the state, the trees were brightening into soft yellows and golds. T. Teenagers drove their pickup trucks slowly along the streets of the town, looking for something to happen, wishing that the summer had not ended. Faint smells of autumn touched the air, the scent of ripening apples, a sourness of dead leaves, cornstalks drying in the fields. In the apple groves at the edge of town, flocks of grackles settled into the branches for the night, squawking. Headlights streamed north on the Gettysburg Road. In the kitchen of a Victorian house near the center of town, Major Nancy Jacks, a veterinarian in the United States Army, stood at a counter making dinner for her children. She slid a plate into the microwave oven and pushed a button. Time to nuke up some chicken for the kids. Nancy Jacks wore sweatpants and a t-shirt, and she was barefoot. Her feet had calluses on them, the result of martial arts training. She had wavy, auburn hair, which was cut above the shoulders, and greenish eyes. Her eyes were actually two colors, green with an inner rim around the iris that was amber. She was a former homecoming queen from Kansas, Miss Agriculture, Kansas State. She had a slender athletic build, and she displayed quick motions, flickery gestures with her arms and hands. Her children were restless and tired, and she worked as fast as she could to fix the dinner. Jamie, who was 5, hung on Nancy's leg. She grabbed the leg of Nancy's sweatpants and pulled, and Nancy lurched sideways, and then Jamie pulled the other way, and Nancy lurched to the other side. Jamie was short for her age and had greenish eyes like her mother. Nancy's son, Jason, who was 7, was watching television in the living room. He was rail-thin and quiet, and when he grew up, he would probably be tall like his father. Nancy's husband, Major Gerald Jacks, whom everyone called Jerry, was also a veterinarian. He was in Texas at a training class, and Nancy was alone with the children. Jerry had telephoned to say that it was hot as hell in Texas, and he missed her badly and wished he was home. She missed him, too. They'd not been apart for more than a few days at a time ever since they had first started dating in college. Nancy and Jerry Jacks were both members of the Army Veterinary Corps, a tiny corps of doggy doctors. They take care of the Army's guard dogs, as well as Army horses, Army cows, Army sheep, Army pigs, Army mules, Army rabbits, Army mice, and Army monkeys. They also inspect the Army's food. Nancy and Jerry had bought the Victorian house not long after they'd been assigned to Fort Detrick, which was nearby, within easy commuting distance. The kitchen was very small, and at the moment you could see plumbing and wires hanging out of the walls. Not far from the kitchen, the living room had a bay window with a collection of tropical plants and ferns in it, and there was a cage among the plants that held an Amazon parrot named Herky. The parrot burst into a song. "Hey-ho, hey-ho, it's home from work we go." "Mom! Mom!" he cried excitedly. His voice sounded like Jason's. "What?" Nancy said. Then she realized it was the parrot. "Nerd brain," she muttered. The parrot wanted to sit on Nancy's shoulder. "Mom! Mom! Jerry! Jamie! Jason!" the parrot shouted, calling everyone in the family. When he didn't get any response, he whistled the Colonel Bogey March from the bridge on the River Kwai. And then, "What? What? Mom! Mom!" Nancy did not want to take Herky out of his cage. She worked quickly, putting plates and silverware out on the counter. Some of the officers at Fort Detrick had noticed a certain abrupt quality in her hand motions, and had accused her of having hands that were too quick to handle delicate work in dangerous situations. Nancy had begun martial arts training partly because she hoped to make her gestures cool and smooth and powerful, and also because she had felt the frustrations of a woman officer trying to advance her career in the Army. She was 5'4" tall. She liked to spar with 6-foot male soldiers, big guys. She enjoyed knocking them around a little bit. It gave her a certain satisfaction to be able to kick higher than the guy's head. She used her feet more than her hands when she sparred with an opponent, because her hands were delicate. She could break 4 boards with a spinning back kick. She had reached the point where she could kill a man with her bare feet, an idea that did not in itself give her much satisfaction. On occasion, she'd come home from her class with a broken toe, a bloody nose, or a black eye. Jerry would just shake his head. Nancy with another shiner. Major Nancy Jacks did all the housework. She couldn't stand housework. Scrubbing grape jelly out of rugs didn't give her a feeling of reward, and in any case, she didn't have time for it. Occasionally, she would go into a paroxysm of cleaning, and she would race around the house for an hour, throwing things into closets. She also did all the cooking for her family. Jerry was useless in the kitchen. Another point of contention was his tendency to buy things impulsively, a motorcycle, a sailboat. Jerry had bought a sailboat when they were stationed at Fort Riley in Kansas. And then there was that god-awful diesel Cadillac with a red leather interior. She and Jerry had commuted to work together in it, but the car had started to lay smoke all over the road even before the payments were finished. One day, she had finally said to Jerry, "You can sit in the driveway in those red leather seats all you want, but I'm not getting in there with you." So they sold the Cadillac and bought a Honda Accord. The Jackses' house was the largest Victorian house in town, a pile of turreted brick with a slate roof and tall windows, and a cupola and wooden paneling made of golden American chestnut. It stood on a street corner near the ambulance station. The sirens woke them up at night. They had bought the house cheap. It had sat on the market a long time, and a story had been going around town that the previous owner had hanged himself in the basement. After the Jackses bought it, the dead man's widow showed up at the door one day. She was a wizened old lady, come to have a look around her old place, and she fixed a blue eye on Nancy and said, "Little girl, you are going to hate this house." "I did." There were other animals in the house besides the parrot. In a wire cage in the living room lived a python named Samson. He would occasionally escape from his cage, wander around the house, and eventually climb up inside the hollow center post of the dining room table and go to sleep. There he would stay for a few days. It gave Nancy a creepy feeling to think that there was a python asleep inside the dining table. You wondered whether the snake was going to wake up while you were eating dinner. Nancy had a study in the cupola at the top of the house. The snake had once escaped from his cage and disappeared for a few days. They pounded and knocked on the dining room table to try to flush him out, but he wasn't there. Late one night, when Nancy was in her study, the snake oozed out of the rafters and hung in front of her face, staring at her with lidless eyes, and she screamed. The family also had an Irish setter and an Airedale terrier. Whenever the Jackses were assigned to a different army post, the animals moved with them in boxes and cages, a portable ecosystem of the Jacks family. Nancy loved Jerry. He was tall and fine-looking, a handsome man with prematurely gray hair. She thought of his hair as silver, to go along with his silver tongue, which he used trying to talk her into buying diesel Cadillacs with red leather interiors. He had sharp brown eyes and a sharp nose, like a hawk's, and he understood her better than anyone else on the earth. Nancy and Jerry Jacks had very little social life outside of their marriage. They'd grown up on farms in Kansas, 20 miles apart as the crow flies, but hadn't known each other as children. They met in veterinary school at Kansas State University and had gotten engaged a few weeks later, and they were married when Nancy was 20. By the time they graduated, they were broke and in debt, with no money to set up a practice as veterinarians, and so they had enlisted in the army together. Since Nancy didn't have time to cook during the week, she would spend her Saturdays cooking. She would make up a beef stew in a crock pot, or she would broil several chickens. Then she'd freeze the food in bags. On weekday nights, she would take a bag out of the freezer and heat it in the microwave. Tonight, while she thawed chicken, she considered the question of vegetables. How about canned green beans? The children like that. Nancy opened a cabinet and pulled down a can of Libby's green beans. She searched through one or two drawers, looking for a can opener. Couldn't find it. She turned to the main junk drawer, which held all the utensils, the stirring spoons, and vegetable peelers. It was a jam-packed nightmare. The hell with the can opener. She pulled a butcher knife out of the drawer. Her father had always warned her not to use a knife to open a can, but Nancy Jacks had never made a point of listening to her father's advice. She jabbed the butcher knife into the can, and the point stuck in the metal. She hit the handle with the heel of her right hand. All of a sudden, her hand slipped down the handle, struck the tang of the blade, and slid down the blade. She felt the edge bite deep. The butcher knife clattered to the floor, and big drops of blood fell on the counter. "Son of a bitch," she said. The knife had sliced through the middle of her right hand on the palm. It was a deep cut. She wondered if the knife had hit bone or cut any tendons. She put pressure on the cut to stanch the bleeding, and went over to the sink, turned on the faucet, and thrust her hand under the stream of water. The sink turned red. She wiggled her fingers. They worked, so she hadn't sliced a tendon. This was not such a bad cut. Holding her hand over her head, she went into the bathroom and found a Band-Aid. She waited for the blood to coagulate, and then she pressed the Band-Aid over the cut, drawing the sides of the cut together to seal the wound. She hated the sight of blood, even if it was her own blood. She had a thing about blood. She knew what some blood could contain. Nancy skipped the children's baths because of the cut on her hand and gave them their usual snuggle in bed. That night, Jamie slept in bed with her. Nancy didn't mind, especially because Jerry was out of town and it made her feel close to her children. Jamie seemed to need the reassurance. Jamie was always a little edgy when Jerry was out of town. Project Ebola, 1983, September 26th. The next morning, Nancy Jacks woke up at 4 o'clock. She got out of bed quietly so as not to wake Jamie, and showered and put on her uniform. She wore green army slacks with a black stripe down the leg, a green army shirt, and in the cold before sunrise, she put on a black military sweater. The sweater displayed the shoulder bars of a major, with gold oak leaves. She drank a Diet Coke to wake herself up, and walked upstairs to her study in the cupola of the house. Today, she might put on a biohazard spacesuit. She was in training for veterinary pathology, the study of disease in animals. Her specialty was turning out to be the effects of biosafety level 4 hot agents. And in the presence of those kinds of agents, you need to wear a spacesuit. She was also studying for her pathology board exams, which were coming up in a week. As the sun rose that morning over the apple orchards and fields to the east of town, she opened her books and hunched over them. Grackles began croaking in the trees, and trucks began to move along the streets of Thermont below her window. The palm of her right hand still throbbed. At 7 o'clock, she went down to the master bedroom and woke Jamie, who was curled up in the bed. She went into Jason's room. Jason was harder to wake, and Nancy had to shake him several times. Then the babysitter arrived, an older woman named Mrs. Trepain, who got Jamie and Jason dressed and gave them their breakfasts, while Nancy climbed back up to the cupola and returned to her books. Mrs. Trepain would see Jason off to the school bus and would watch Jamie at home until Nancy came back from work that evening. At 7:30, Nancy closed her books and kissed her children goodbye. She thought to herself, have to remember to stop at the bank and get some money to pay Mrs. Trepain. She drove the Honda alone to work, heading south on the Gettysburg Road along the foot of Catoctin Mountain. As she approached Fort Detrick in the city of Frederick, the traffic thickened and slowed. She turned off the highway and arrived at the main gate of the base. A guard waved her through. She turned right, drove past the parade grounds with its flagpole, and parked her car near a massive, almost windowless building made of concrete and yellow bricks that covered almost 10 acres of ground. Tall vent pipes on the roof discharged filtered exhaust air that was being pumped out of sealed biological laboratories inside the building. This was the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, or USAMRID. Military people often call USAMRID the Institute. When they call the place USAMRID, they draw the word in a military way, which gives it some hang time in the air. The mission of USAMRID is medical defense. The Institute conducts research into ways to protect soldiers against biological weapons and natural infectious diseases. It specializes in drugs, vaccines, and biocontainment. At the Institute, there are always a number of programs going on simultaneously. Research into vaccines for various kinds of bacteria, such as anthrax and botulism. Research into the characteristics of viruses that might infect American troops, either naturally or in the form of a battlefield weapon. Beginning with the Second World War, Army labs at Fort Detrick performed research into offensive biological weapons. The Army was developing strains of lethal bacteria and viruses that could be loaded into bombs and dropped on an enemy. In 1969, President Richard M. Nixon signed an executive order that outlawed the development of offensive biological weapons in the United States. From then on, the Army labs were converted to peaceful uses, and USAMRID was founded. It devoted itself to developing protective vaccines, and it concentrated on basic research into ways to control lethal microorganisms. The Institute knows ways to stop a monster virus before it ignites an explosive chain of lethal transmission in the human race. Major Nancy Jacks entered the building through the back entrance and showed her security badge to a guard behind a desk, who nodded and smiled at her. She headed into the main block of containment zones, traveling through a maze of corridors. There were soldiers everywhere, dressed in fatigues, and there were civilian scientists and technicians wearing ID badges. People seemed very busy, and rarely did anyone stop to chat with someone else in the corridors. Nancy wanted to see what had happened to the Ebola monkeys during the night. She walked along a biosafety level 0 corridor, heading for a level 4 biocontainment area known as AA5, or the Ebola suite. The levels are numbered 0, 2, 3, and finally 4, the highest. For some reason, there is no level 1. All the containment levels at the Institute, from level 2 to level 4, are kept under negative air pressure, so that if a leak develops, air will flow into the zones rather than outward to the normal world. The suite known as AA5 was a group of negative pressure biocontainment rooms that had been set up as a research lab for Ebola virus by a civilian army scientist named Eugene Johnson. He was an expert in Ebola and its sister, Marburg. He'd infected several monkeys with Ebola virus, and he had been giving them various drugs to see if they would stop the Ebola infection. In recent days, the monkeys had begun to die. Nancy had joined Johnson's Ebola project as a pathologist. It was her job to determine the cause of death in the monkeys. She came to a window in a wall. The window was made of heavy glass, like that in an aquarium, and it looked directly into the Ebola suite, directly into level 4. You couldn't see the monkeys through this window. Every morning, a civilian animal caretaker put on a spacesuit and went inside to feed the monkeys and clean their cages and check on their physical condition. This morning, there was a piece of paper taped to the inside of the glass with handwritten lettering on it. It had been left there by a caretaker. The note said that during the night, two of the animals had gone down. That is, they had crashed and bled out. When she saw the note, she knew that she would be putting on a spacesuit and going in to dissect the monkeys. Ebola virus destroyed an animal's internal organs, and the carcass deteriorated abruptly after death. It softened, and the tissues turned into jelly, even if you put it in a refrigerator to keep it cold. You wanted to dissect the animals quickly, before the spontaneous liquefaction began, because you can't dissect gumbo. When Nancy Jacks first applied to join the pathology group at the Institute, the colonel in charge of it didn't want to accept her. Nancy thought it was because she was a woman. He said to her, "This work is not for a married female. You are either going to neglect your work or neglect your family." One day, she brought her resume into his office, hoping to persuade him to accept her. He said, "I can have anybody I want in my group," implying that he didn't want her because she wasn't good enough. And he mentioned the great thoroughbred stallion's secretariat. "If I want to have secretariat in my group," he said, "I can get secretariat." "Well, sir, I am no plow horse," she roared at him, and slammed her resume on his desk. He reconsidered the matter and allowed her to join the group. When you begin working with biological agents, the Army starts you in biosafety level 2, and then you move up to level 3. You don't go into level 4 until you have a lot of experience, and the Army may never allow you to work there. In order to work in the lower levels, you must have a number of vaccinations. Nancy had vaccinations for yellow fever, Q fever, Rift Valley fever, the VEE, EEE, and WEE complex, brain viruses that live in horses, and tularemia, anthrax, and botulism. And of course, she had had a series of shots for rabies since she was a veterinarian. Her immune system reacted badly to all the shots. They made her sick. The Army therefore yanked her out of the vaccination program. At this point, Nancy Jacks was essentially washed up. She couldn't proceed with any kind of work on Level 3 agents because she couldn't tolerate the vaccinations. There was only one way she could continue working with dangerous infectious agents. She had to get herself assigned to work in a spacesuit in Level 4 areas. There aren't any vaccines for Level 4 hot agents. A Level 4 hot agent is a lethal virus for which there is no vaccine and no cure. Ebola virus is named for the Ebola River, which is the headstream of the Mongala River, a tributary of the Congo or Zaire River. The Ebola River empties tracts of rainforest, winding past scattered villages. The first known emergence of Ebola Zaire, the hottest type of Ebola virus, occurred in September 1976, when it erupted simultaneously in 55 villages near the headwaters of the Ebola River. It seemed to come out of nowhere and killed 9 out of 10 people it infected. Ebola Zaire is the most feared agent at the Institute. The general feeling around USAMRID has always been, those people who work with Ebola are crazy. To mess around with Ebola is an easy way to die. Better to work with something safer, such as anthrax. Eugene Johnson, the civilian biohazard expert who was running the Ebola research program at the Institute, had a reputation for being a little bit wild. He's something of a legend to the handful of people in the world who really know about hot agents and how to handle them. He's one of the world's leading Ebola hunters. Gene Johnson is a large man, not to say massive, with a broad, heavy face and loose-flying, disheveled brown hair and a bushy brown beard and a gut that hangs over his belt and glaring deep eyes. If Gene Johnson were to put on a black leather jacket, he could pass for a roadie with the Grateful Dead. He doesn't look at all like a man who works for the Army. He has a reputation for being a top-notch field epidemiologist, a person who studies viral diseases in the wild. But for some reason, he doesn't often get around to publishing his work. That explains his somewhat mysterious reputation. When people who know Johnson's work talk about him, you hear things like, "Gene Johnson did this, Gene Johnson did that." And it all sounds clever and imaginative. He's a rather shy man, somewhat suspicious of people, deeply suspicious of viruses. I think I've never met someone who's more afraid of viruses than Gene Johnson. And what makes his fear impressive is the fact that it's a deep intellectual respect, rooted in knowledge. He spent years traveling across Central Africa in search of the reservoirs of Ebola and Marburg viruses. He had virtually ransacked Africa looking for these life forms, but despite his searches, he had never found them in their natural hiding places. No one knew where any of the filoviruses came from. No one knew where they lived in nature. The trail had petered out in the forests and savannas of Central Africa. To find the hidden reservoir of Ebola was one of Johnson's great ambitions. No one around the Institute wanted to get involved with his Ebola project. Ebola, the slate wiper, did things to people that you didn't want to think about. The organism was too frightening to handle, even for those who were comfortable and adept in spacesuits. They didn't care to do research on Ebola because they didn't want Ebola to do research on them. They didn't know what kind of host the virus lived in, whether it was a fly or a bat or a tick or a spider or a scorpion or some kind of reptile or an amphibian such as a frog or a newt. Or maybe it lived in leopards or elephants. And they didn't know exactly how the virus spread, how it jumped from host to host. Gene Johnson had suffered recurrent nightmares about Ebola virus ever since he began to work with it. He would wake up in a cold sweat. His dreams went more or less the same way. He would be wearing his spacesuit while holding Ebola in his gloved hand, holding some kind of liquid tainted with Ebola. Suddenly the liquid would be running all over his glove, and then he would realize that his glove was full of pinholes, and the liquid was dribbling over his bare hand and running inside his spacesuit. He would come awake with a start, saying to himself, "My God, there's been an exposure." And then he would find himself in his bedroom with his wife sleeping beside him. In reality, Ebola had not yet made a decisive, irreversible breakthrough into the human race. But it seemed close to doing that. It had been emerging in microbreaks here and there in Africa. The worry was that a microbreak would develop into an unstoppable tidal wave. If the virus killed 9 out of 10 people it infected, and there was no vaccine or cure for it, you could see the possibilities. The possibilities were global. Johnson liked to say to people that we don't really know what Ebola has done in the past, and we don't know what it might do in the future. Ebola was unpredictable. An airborne strain of Ebola could emerge and circle around the world in about 6 weeks, like the flu, killing large numbers of people, or it might forever remain a secret feeder at the margins, taking down humans a few at a time. Ebola is a rather simple virus, as simple as a firestorm. It kills humans with swift efficiency and with a devastating range of effects. Ebola is distantly related to measles, mumps, and rabies. It's also related to certain pneumonia viruses, to the parainfluenza virus, which causes colds in children, and to the respiratory syncytial virus, which can cause fatal pneumonia in a person who has AIDS. In its own evolution, through unknown hosts and hidden pathways in the rainforest, Ebola seems to have developed the worst elements of all the above viruses. Like measles, it triggers a rash all over the body. Some of its effects resemble rabies, psychosis, madness. Other of its effects look eerily like a bad cold. The Ebola virus particle contains only 7 different proteins, 7 large molecules. 3 of these proteins are vaguely understood, and 4 of the proteins are completely unknown. Their structure and their function is a mystery. Whatever these Ebola proteins do, they seem to target the immune system for special attack. In this, they are like HIV, which also destroys the immune system. But unlike the onset of HIV, the attack by Ebola is explosive. As Ebola sweeps through you, your immune system fails, and you seem to lose your ability to respond to viral attack. Your body becomes a city under siege, with its gates thrown open and hostile armies pouring in, making camp in the public squares and setting everything on fire. And from the moment Ebola enters your bloodstream, the war is already lost. You are almost certainly doomed. You can't fight off Ebola the way you fight off a cold. Ebola does in 10 days what it takes AIDS 10 years to accomplish. It's not really known how Ebola is transmitted from person to person. Army researchers believe that Ebola virus traveled through direct contact with blood and bodily fluids, in the same way the AIDS virus travels. Ebola seemed to have other routes of travel as well. Many of the people in Africa who came down with Ebola had handled Ebola-infected cadavers. It seems that one of Ebola's paths goes from the dead to the living, winding in trickles of uncoagulated blood and slimes that come out of the dead body. In Zaire, during the 1976 outbreak, grieving relatives kissed and embraced the dead or prepared the body for burial, and then, 3 to 14 days later, they broke with Ebola. Gene Johnson's Ebola experiment was simple. He would infect a few monkeys with the virus, and then he would treat them with drugs in the hope that they would get better. That way, he might discover a drug that would fight Ebola virus or possibly cure it. Monkeys are nearly identical to human beings in a biological sense, which is why they are used in medical experiments. Humans and monkeys are both primates, and Ebola feeds on primates in the same way that a predator consumes certain kinds of flesh. Ebola can't tell the difference between a human being and a monkey. The virus jumps easily back and forth between them. Nancy Jacks volunteered to work as the pathologist on Johnson's Ebola project. It was level 4 work, which she was qualified to do because she didn't need to be vaccinated. She was eager to prove herself and eager to continue working with lethal viruses. However, some people around the Institute were skeptical of her ability to work in a spacesuit in level 4. She was a married female. She might panic. They claimed that her hands looked nervous or clumsy, not good for work with level 4 hot agents. People felt that she might cut herself or stick herself with a contaminated needle or stick someone else. Her hands became a safety issue. Her immediate superior was Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Johnson. He's not related to Gene Johnson, the civilian who was the head of the Ebola project. Tony Johnson is a soft-spoken man and a cool customer. Now he had to decide whether to allow her to go into biosafety level 4. Wanting to be sure he understood the situation, he sent word around the Institute. Who knows Nancy Jacks? Who can comment on her strengths and weaknesses? Major Jerry Jacks, Nancy's husband, showed up in Lieutenant Colonel Johnson's office. Jerry was against the idea of his wife putting on a spacesuit. He argued strongly against it. He said that there had been family discussions about Nancy working with Ebola virus. Family discussions. Jerry had said to Nancy, "You're the only wife I've got." He didn't wear a biological spacesuit himself at work, and he didn't want his wife to wear one either. His biggest concern was that she would be handling Ebola. He couldn't stand the idea that his wife, the woman he loved, the mother of their children, would hold in her hands a monstrous life form that's lethal and incurable. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Johnson listened to what Major Jerry Jacks had to say, and listened to what other people had to say, and then he felt he should speak with Nancy himself, and so he called her into his office. He could see that she was tense. He watched her hands as she talked. They looked fine to him, not clumsy, and not too quick either. He decided that the rumors he'd been hearing about her hands were unfounded. She said to him, "I don't want any special favors." Well, she wasn't going to get any special favors. "I'm going to put you in the Ebola program," he said. He told her that he would allow her to put on a space suit and go into the Ebola area, and that he would accompany her on the first few trips to teach her how to do it and to observe her hands at work. He would watch her like a hawk. He believed that she was ready for total immersion in a hot zone. As he spoke, she broke down and cried in front of him. Had a few tears, as he would later recall. They were tears of happiness. At that moment, to hold Ebola virus in her hands was what she wanted more than anything else in the world. 1300 hours. Nancy spent the morning doing paperwork in her office. After lunch, she removed her diamond engagement ring and her wedding band and locked them in her desk drawer. She dropped by Tony Johnson's office and asked him if he was ready to go in. They went downstairs and along a corridor to the Ebola suite. There was only one locker room leading into it. Tony Johnson insisted that Nancy Jax go in first to get changed. He would follow. The room was small and contained a few lockers along one wall, some shelves, and a mirror over a sink. She undressed, removing all of her clothing, including her underwear, and put everything in her locker. She left the Band-Aid stuck to her hand. From a shelf, she took up a sterile surgical scrub suit, green pants and a green shirt, the clothing that a surgeon wears in an operating room, and she dragged on the pants and tied the drawstring at the waist and snapped the shirt's snaps. You were not allowed to wear anything under the scrub suit, no underwear. She pulled a cloth surgical cap over her head and tucked her hair up into the cap while looking in the mirror. She did not appear nervous, but she was starting to feel a little bit nervous. This was only her second trip into a hot area. Standing in her bare feet, she turned away from the mirror and faced a door leading into level 2. A deep blue light streamed through a window in the door, ultraviolet light. Viruses fall apart under ultraviolet light, which smashes their genetic material and makes them unable to replicate. As she opened the door and entered level 2, she felt the door stick against her pull, sucked in by a difference of air pressure, and a gentle drag of air whispered around her shoulders and traveled inward toward the hot zone. This was negative air pressure, designed to keep hot agents from drifting outward. The door closed behind her, and she was in level 2. The blue light bathed her face. She walked through a water shower stall that contained an ultraviolet light, a bar of soap, and some ordinary shampoo. The shower stall led into a bathroom, where there was a shelf that held some clean white socks. She put on a pair of socks and pushed through another door into level 3. This was a room known as the staging area. It contained a desk with a telephone and a sink. A cylindrical waxed cardboard box sat on the floor beside the desk. It was a biohazard container known as a hat box or ice cream container. A hat box is blazed with biohazard symbols, which are red, spiky, three-petaled flowers, and it's used for storing and transporting infectious waste. This hat box was empty. It was only a makeshift chair. She found a box of latex rubber surgical gloves and a plastic shaker full of baby powder. She shook the baby powder onto her hands and pulled on the gloves. Then she found a roll of sticky tape, and she tore off several strips of tape and hung them in a row on the edge of the desk. Then she taped herself. Taking up one strip at a time, she taped the cuffs of her gloves to the sleeves of her scrub shirt, running the tape around the cuff to make a seal. She then taped her socks to her trousers. Now she wore one layer of protection between herself and the replicative other. Lieutenant Colonel Johnson came in through level 2 wearing a surgical scrub suit. He put on rubber gloves and began taping them to his sleeves, and he taped his socks to his pants. Nancy turned to the right, into an antechamber, and found her spacesuit hanging on a rack. It was a Kempturian biological spacesuit, and it was marked in letters across the chest, J-A-A-X. A Kempturian is also known as a blue suit, because it's bright blue. It's a pressurized, heavy-duty plastic spacesuit that meets government specifications for work with airborne hot agents. She opened up the spacesuit and laid it down on the concrete floor and stepped into it, feet first. She pulled it up to her armpits and slid her arms into the sleeves until her fingers entered the gloves. The suit had brown rubber gloves that were attached by gaskets at the cuffs.